Hello, this is John Cleese, and you're listening to the Podcast Network.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. And now, here's Rod Adams and the Atomic Show. It's atomic. Yeah. It's atomic.
Hi, this is Rod Adams coming to you from College Station, Texas. It's time for Atomic Show number 85. It's a little bit of an unusual show. It is a series of interviews of people who had booths at the American Nuclear Society student conference held at Texas A&M University the weekend of February 28th through March 2nd, 2008. Hope you enjoy, but if you don't like those kind of shows, tune out and come back again next time.
The red button wasn't on. We've gone through all this wonderful stuff and I didn't record word.
Start again.
Okay, is my face red?
Yeah, no.
This
looks sunburned.
Okay,
this looks sunburned, yeah.
Well, that's a workout I did this morning. I got a fluster. Okay, I'm standing here with Michael Vasquez, Matthew Young, and Joseph Lopez of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And we're at the American Nuclear Society student conference being held in College Station, Texas. It's at Texas A&M University. And Michael, can you tell me a little bit about yourself and what you do for the NRC?
Okay. I'm a senior enforcement specialist here with the NRC. I've been with the NRC about 20 years. Before that, I'd been a senior inspector and an inspector with the NRC. My primary job is when the inspectors go out and find significant violations, and they come back, and I help coordinate the enforcement, the NRC's enforcement action against licensees like that. So I get involved in, okay, what's the violation? Well, how do we package it? What's the message we want to give to the licensee? Should we issue a civil penalty? Should we take stronger action? Should we not take such strong action? On and on.
Okay. Now, when you guys calculate a civil penalty, what kind of considerations go into how big the penalty should be?
There are a multitude of considerations. They're all, basically, we evaluate the circumstances for that case. Okay, so if we're talking about a nuclear power plant, the enforcement policy has base civil penalties depending on the severity of the violation. Okay, and also, for instance, if we're also talking about an industrial radiographer, a materials licensee, the base civil penalties are less, obviously. Okay, but again, they're also based on the severity of the violation and all the other circumstances around it. And so we just look at how the violation occurred, why did it occur, the circumstances surrounding who identified it, did they correct it, did they not correct it, and was it timely?
Okay, so I imagine that a self-reported, hey, we found this in a surveillance, is going to be a lot less than one of your inspectors finding something.
Absolutely. Generally, that's true. Though there are, we look at, okay, well, why did it occur in the beginning, in the first place as well?
Okay.
And we ask, okay, is it reasonable for them to have found it earlier or not? So we also look at those angles. But generally, so if they find it, they're going to get credit for identification.
Okay.
Obviously, we didn't find it. They did.
Okay. Now, so how long have you been with the NRC?
I've been with the NRC about 20 years.
Okay. And what did you do before you went to the NRC?
Coming out of college, I'm a graduate of Texas A&M University.
So that's one of the reasons you came back here.
That's why.
I'll sign up for that trip.
That's right. That's right. I paid them. Let me come and I'll pay you. No, I'm just joking. After college, I went to work for an engineering consulting company, and I worked at several other nuclear power plants as providing on-site support. But that life is a little bit hard because you're always having to travel out to different sites around the country. And then I got married and decided, well, I needed to settle down and not be traveling quite so much. So
yeah, I guess for some people, traveling is a burden. Other people, traveling is fun. And standing next to you is somebody who's a younger man. And okay, he may be one of the guys who's here to travel a little bit more.
Yeah.
Matthew, can you tell me a little bit about what you do with the NRC?
Yes, I'm in the Nuclear Safety Professional Development Program that they offer. It's a two-year training program that gets you up to speed. No matter what your background is, they train everybody the same, teach you about the nuclear power plants, the different types, how they operate, if something were to occur, transient, they teach you how the plant's going to respond. And they get you up to speed in 2 years, and in those 2 years, you get to go on 2 3-month rotations. One is an inner office or a headquarters rotation up in Washington, D.C., and the other one is actually out to a reactor site where you assist or act as a resident inspector. There are 2 resident inspectors at each site, and I was fortunate enough to actually act as a resident inspector at San Onofre Nuclear Generating Station out in California this past September. And in that time, I got to be interfacing with the vice president of generation for the site, upper management, all their operations. They came to me if there was a problem, and then I relayed it back to the region with all the technical analysts and stuff there, and we went through the processes that we go through. And it just so happened this year I got to be out there when they had the fires out there. We got to provide round-the-clock coverage. I was in the control rooms relaying information about how close the fire was to the plant, how are the systems doing in the plant, the grid, and everything. So that's one aspect that we get to do. Whenever I do graduate, which will be after the 2 years is up, you go through a certification process, and you get call boarded. And there's 3 senior inspectors that sit down and grill you and ask you all the stuff that you just learned in the last 2 years.
Okay.
And then after that, you become either a resident inspector or a traveling reactor inspector. And the reactor inspector, you travel out for a week, and you inspect a specific engineering aspect of the plant. And a resident inspector is on site, and they're more the day-to-day operations of the plant, ensuring that, you know, they're operating correctly and the corrective actions on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, the resident inspector had been around ever since shipping port, if I remember correctly. That was something that Admiral Rickover insisted when they built the shipping port, was to have somebody who was outside of the plant operations, kind of looking over the shoulder.
Yeah, the resident inspector program has been around for quite a while in the NRC, and that's exactly the idea. Is you have at least 2 inspectors out at every facility that whose day-to-day mission or day-to-day duties are to show up at the plant, and they have a defined inspection program that they go through, and they look at various angles and various aspects of different programs.
Now, one of the questions about the resident inspector program is I've been to a couple of presentations here talking about smaller reactors, much smaller reactors, something on the order of 30, 50, 100 megawatts, because people are interested in distributed power generation, that kind of stuff. Now, what do you think the NRC is going to do in terms of resident inspectors if people start building smaller plants?
Oh, I hate to speculate on something like that. There's too many questions that need to be answered, and that's so far off. I really don't know about those kinds of plants right now.
Yeah, we're more concerned right now with the operating reactors, so that if something were to happen with one of those, then it's going to stop all nuclear generation and stuff.
Right.
So we want to make sure that we focus on the operating reactors right now.
Okay.
Yeah, but I think it's important to recognize in the program that Matthew is going through, we take a college graduate and we provide them. So you don't have to be a nuclear engineer. You can be a mechanical engineer, electrical engineer, and not have ever seen a nuclear power plant before. And we take someone fresh out of college and we train them through this 2-year program, and not only the classroom training, but accompanying other inspectors, and like Matthew said, going out to the sites as well, so that then at the time they graduate from that program, they are ready to hit the ground running. And this program was specifically designed to really train what we think are going to be the next generation of managers within the NRC.
Yeah. Now, my background is I was in the nuclear navy for quite some time. And I know a lot of people who are getting out of that area who've done a lot of inspecting already. I mean, that's one of the things that we do. We have surveillance programs and that kind of stuff. How about a guy who's coming out of the nuclear navy? Would he be a welcome addition to resident inspector program?
Well, not just a resident inspector, anywhere within the NRC. Yes, the nuclear navy provides a lot of very good training. We have a lot of former Navy nukes in our agency, and we have a lot who are senior managers as well, going up and down the ranks. Any ex-Navy nuke would be highly recruited throughout the nuclear industry. The advantage the NRC offers, though, is that their prior government service also counts toward their retirement. It's all federal service. So you get to continue with that time in service. And the other companies can't provide it. We can, because obviously we are the federal government.
Sure. Now, the NRC, if I remember correctly, is rated as one of the best places the best place in the federal government to work.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, who did that survey?
Well, it was a survey that all the employees were, well, that
it was a survey conducted by OPM.
Personnel management, okay.
And
is that something they do on a regular basis, and you guys have been up there for a while?
We started the survey, about 3 or 4 years ago. Maybe 2 years ago. I think last year we were rated number 3 overall, and this year we were rated number 1.
All right.
It's important to recognize those are employee surveys, and so based on the responses of the employees within that agency, the positive responses, we were rated number 1. We had the highest ratings by our own employees as compared with other agencies, and they were all very high. And there's a reason for that. We are a good place to work. The attitude, the atmosphere is all very, very positive. It's very family friendly. We have a mission that we need to accomplish, and we all are conscientious about that mission, making certain that truly there is a contribution to safety. And we also keep balance with family life on that as well. And because of that, I think that's why we got rated the best place.
Well, you mentioned that you had the opportunity to move from a job that required a lot of travel to one that was a lot less travel. And that's some, that kind of ability to move from one type of employment to another within the same agency is always a good thing.
Yeah, and recognize we have 4 regional offices and we have a headquarters office. And we encourage our people, even after, graduating from the NSPDP program, we encourage our people to not just sit in one place in one job, but to expand their career and try and meet their career objectives. If that means moving to a different place, to maybe moving to another region or to Washington,
that's fine. 3-month rotations.
Yeah, and we also do, 3-month rotations. So we give the employees an opportunity to lay out their career objectives and how they want to meet them, and we do our best to try and fulfill those needs and try and meet them.
Are you still under the GS type arrangement, or are you moving to this NSPS, or have you heard of that within the federal government? I guess some parts of the government are moving to a different personnel system where they don't have the same kind of step ratings as you do in the GS, instead of having GS 1 through 15 and various steps along the way. Within the DOD, for example, they've only got 3 organizations. You got GA 1, 2, and 3, and it's kind of a salary band. But you guys you haven't heard anything about that, would you?
No, I haven't heard anything about that.
That makes it one of the better places to work in the federal government. That process has been very painful in DOD.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And a lot of the employees aren't particularly excited about it because it makes it a lot less predictable.
I see.
It gives managers a lot bigger impact on the person's salary.
Oh, I see. No, I'm not familiar with that at all.
All right, good. Well, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it, and I hope that good luck to you, Matthew. And I guess, do you have a lot of call cards that you have to get filled out as part of
yes,
your program?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
That came straight out of the Navy, I think.
I was going to say. I recognize that. You said a lot of Navy managers. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Takes a while.
I can always, if you want me to edit, I can always edit later. But okay, I'm standing at the Black and Veatch booth with Keith
Gussich
and Shelley Arnett of Black and Veatch Corporation. And we're here at the American Nuclear Society student conference being held in College Station, Texas, at Texas A&M University. So, Keith, why are you here? What's your booth trying to do? What's your measure for success at this conference?
Well, part of our measure for success, we've been involved with Black and Veatch. We've been involved with recruiting activities for the past 10 years, more or less, and especially with nuclear, the Renaissance picking up steam, and everyone's looking for the new build opportunities. It's an exciting time to brand our company again, get our name back out there into the marketplace, but as well as to showcase to other companies, other universities, what we're about. A lot of people sometimes don't know what Black and Veatch is about, so it's a way for us to tell everyone a little bit about our company, but it's a way for us also to introduce ourselves to the students.
Okay, well, the people that are listening to this can't see your nice poster back here, so can you tell me a little bit about what Black and Veatch does?
Sure. Black and Veatch is located in Overland Park, Kansas, so we're centrally located in the U.S., and we're a full EPC company. Basically, what that means is we do engineering, procurement, and construction work. From a nuclear side, since we're here at a nuclear conference, we specialize in two main areas. Existing plants, we perform operating plant services work, whether it be engineering design, plant modifications, security modifications work for existing plants, but we also have new build capabilities as well. So what that means is we're able to go ahead and help different technologies and utilities thinking about building a new plant with pretty much their reactor technologies, plant-specific, site-specific information as well, but work with the NRC to make sure that we're following their guidelines. So it's a collaborative effort across the board, but we encompass pretty much the full picture of what you can consider for building a nuclear plant.
Okay, now, nobody's built a nuclear plant in the U.S. for a long time, so what kind of experience can you bring to the Renaissance in terms of some of your other construction projects that you've been working on in the last 30 years?
Yeah, I mean, great question there. I mean, what we're trying to do is leverage our other existing fossil side of the plants, you know, power delivery, coal, combustion turbine. You know, we've had projects and domestically but internationally go extremely well. Our biggest success measure is that we execute projects extremely well to meet the client's needs. But one of our strong points, too, is what I consider soft skills, is we're an integrity-focused and a very trustworthy company. So we really provide the honesty up front building with clients. We use that a lot to leverage clients thinking about building a nuclear plant. What we are doing, though, is we're really getting involved with current utilities that have existing plants today and helping them modify their existing plants so when they do consider possibly building a new plant, we're already at the forefront of working, you know, adhering to their needs, adhering to their procedures to have that opportunity in the future to build a plant in the future. But as well, we're getting involved a lot with alliances with the likes of like GE. So we're getting involved with some of the well-known names out there as well, and, you know, not many outfits have that opportunity. So we're taking advantage of really building relationships as well.
Okay. Now, are you involved in any of the partnerships that are already kind of moving down pretty far down the path of licensing and procuring a new plant?
Well, it's hard to really say exactly how far down the line people are at this point now, but we have our hands involved with three of the main technologies I think people are looking to select. And it's, you know, part of it is obviously what I consider the infancy stages of building that now, working on the studies, working on potentially where they're going to have their plant site located. So we're at the forefront right now. We're anxious and waiting for the timing of a new build to occur.
Okay. All right, and Shelley, what is your job within the? Why are you here at this conference?
I think it's mainly to lay down the format for the future. I mean, the next 5 to 10 years with Black and Beach and our nuclear department is going to be, you know, ramping up, and so just getting our name out there for students to be aware of us and know the potential that we have and all the partnerships that we are forming right now.
How big a company is Black and Beach?
We have 9,600 professionals worldwide. We have over 100 offices. We've completed projects in over 100 countries. So it's a very large global company.
So if somebody has the desire to do some traveling, Black and Beach might be a good choice?
We have a lot of potential there. If the student wants to travel, they can go be a globetrotter, go around the world a couple times. If they want to stay locally, they can do that too. There's lots of opportunities.
Now, what kind of graduates are you looking for? You're probably hiring in several areas. What kind of areas are you looking at?
A lot of different disciplines. Chemical engineering, mechanical engineering, civil engineering, of course, nuclear engineering as well. So we look at all of them.
You got any room for an English major?
Marketing?
Yeah. Potentially, it depends on, there's always a need. You just have to figure out exactly the right place to put people.
You know, it's funny, our procurement area has everything from people that have been violin instruments, played those, to piano, to psychologists, so everything in between.
Yeah, when you're talking about buying things, you don't necessarily have to be an engineer to figure out who's got the best deal.
No, exactly, and I think a lot of it comes down to is, people that have business degrees, you know, people from all walks of life, really. We're a very diversified company. I mean that from a diversification of the different type of generations. People come from all over the world to work for us, but we also have a diverse background as far as education levels, skill levels. So, you know, we consider ourselves, part of our motto is One Black and Beach, and we really do see that with the amount of people we do and the type of projects we take on.
Now, what if somebody has an undergraduate degree? Is Black and Beach a place where after they work for a while, they might be able to get some educational assistance?
Yeah, we have an education reimbursement program. And so what they have to do is just get approval from their supervisors, fill out some paperwork, and start. We've got some great, you know, local universities at most of our offices here in the U.S., so it's not a problem.
Do you have formal partnerships with some of those universities already? You know?
I wouldn't say necessarily formal partnerships, but we encourage our employees to go out there and reach out to the university of their choice as far as it fits their needs, whether they want to do it online or actually go classroom training, and then we just offer the assistance to help pay for it on a yearly basis.
Great. Well, good luck to you at the conference. Hope you find some people that want to know more about Black and Beach, and I think you guys also talked to some of the other vendors around, right?
Yeah, definitely.
All right, bye.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
All right, I'm here at the ANS Student Conference in College Station, Texas, at the Texas A&M University, and I'm at the kind of vendor recruitment session, where the vendors have or people have booths set up and they're talking to the students. And I'm here with Tony Robinson, Curtis Williams, and Julie Weber, who are at the booth for the Southern California Edison. So, Tony, can you tell me why you're here? Why are you here at this student conference?
Well, we're here because we all work at the San Onofre Nuclear Plant, and we're here to try to attract some students to either join us through our internship program or our new grad program.
Can you tell me a little about the internship program? That sounds kind of interesting.
You catch me on the spot here. Okay. Now, internship program is a program that we have that allows students come work for us on a part-time basis where they can actually bring their classroom experience and use it on the job, you know, hands-on experience. And, you know, they work for us for, you know, 3 months in the summertime. And, you know, once their internship is over, we may bring them back for more internships. And then after their internship, we always like to convert those students to new grads.
Okay, so these are just interns would be people who are still in college and are looking for something to do in between semesters.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
So, Julie, how long have you worked for Southern California Edison?
I started as an intern 2 summers ago, and I graduated school almost a year ago and have been full-time ever since, so about a year and a half total.
Okay, are you an engineer or an operations?
I am a mechanical engineer working in PRA.
Okay. PRA? Explain to people, what is PRA? I know the acronym, but they don't.
PRA is probabilistic risk assessment, and what we do is we calculate the risk of there being core damage based on any given configuration of the plant. So we provide an insight to ensure safe operation of the plant.
Okay. Do you have to go through any qualification process once you graduate before you can actually start doing this analysis?
Once you graduate, your group trains you in what you need to know. So you are taught hands-on by a mentor, and once you prove that you are capable of performing a task on your own, then you are actually allowed to perform work individually. But it's always checked, and there's always people to ask questions too. So it's a great learning experience.
Okay, so where is San Onofre Nuclear Generating Station?
It is about halfway between Los Angeles and San Diego on the coast on Camp Pendleton Marine Base land.
Sounds like a nice place to live.
It's beautiful. You leave work and there's sunset over the ocean. How could you not want to live there?
So, how difficult is it to find a place to live in that area of the world, though?
Excellent question. It is a more expensive place to live, but it's definitely not impossible. Your dream home, you won't get it in your first year, but a little patience and you'll be just fine.
Well, I don't think any job gives you your dream home in your first year. So, Curtis, can you talk to me a little about how long have you been with Southern California Edison?
I graduated in 2002, and I've been with Southern California Edison for about 6 years now. And the department that I work in, I'm actually a design engineer in the electrical analysis group.
Sounds like an interesting opportunity. Are you excited about any possibility for new build in California?
It would be great. I know right now we have some legislative issues that we have to work out before we get the permission to actually build a new unit out there. But I'm actually president of the North American Young Generation and Nuclear Society in Southern California region. And right now we're actually trying to encourage more people to write their legislative to allow us that permission to build these more units. If we had more units, then we can lower that cost of electricity and get more people out there.
Yeah, I know that California's got a huge program for zero-emission solar panels, but they don't seem to like this zero-emission nuclear very well yet.
Yeah, that is true. Some people have a problem with looking out their backyard and seeing a nuclear power plant out there.
Now, does San Onofre have room to expand? Is that a site that has, I mean, there's a lot of sites around the country that were originally designed for more reactors than what they have. Is San Onofre one of those?
See, we do have the land for it, but initially we weren't designed to actually build more units, mainly because, of course, like you heard, we are located on a marine base. And not only that, we still have that legislative issue that prevents us from expanding to build more units right now.
Well, it sounds like at least one thing that people complain about with nuclear is solved for you guys. People think about the security issue for nuclear power plants. You guys got a bunch of Marines by that can keep you safe, I guess.
That is so true. Whether they come by land, sea, or in the air, we got the Marines right there.
All right. Thank you very much for your time, Curtis.
I appreciate it.
All right. Now I've moved on to the Argonne National Laboratory, still at the ANS Student Conference being held at College Station, Texas A&M University. I'm with David Porner and Andrew Hebnan from the Argonne National Laboratory. So, David, can you tell me why you're here and what you have, what your interest is in this student conference?
Sure. I think we have several interests. We provided a workshop yesterday introducing the concept of the fast reactor and the global and its role in the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership, because that part of the reactor regular design industry is not really represented well in most college curricula. And today we're here at the Career Fair to share some things about what we do at Argonne with the students that are here. We have a lot of information about the opportunities that are available for students that are both undergrads and graduates to expand their experience while they're in school at the National Labs and at Argonne in particular.
Okay, expand their experience in school. You mean like internships and that kind of program?
Absolutely. Internships, co-ops. We have a large number of postdocs. We have a lot of, we actually sponsor a lot of graduate students into research programs. We have some other opportunities that are integrated with the IAEA to give students an opportunity to do some travel.
IAEA?
Absolutely. Actually, Argonne.
No, you got to translate. Okay?
International Atomic Energy Agency.
Okay, I'm trying to help people avoid the acronym speak because
it's so
not
hard.
Everybody knows what those mean.
Thank you, Ron. And it's so hard because we speak in acronyms all the time. But so we have some.
That's the way we keep the riffraff out.
Right.
We have to make sure they know the language.
Something like that.
Okay, so what can they do with the IAEA? That sounds like a neat place. That's Vienna, Austria, right?
Or so, Argonne and Brookhaven, actually, there's another table around the way here, coordinate the IAEA's programs where students can go for a year or 2 years and actually support the International Atomic Energy Agency's activities worldwide. And so Argonne provides a lot of the training for those folks.
Okay.
Before they go.
So, Andrew, how long have you been with the Argonne National Lab?
I've been there about 8.5 years.
Okay.
Currently, I'm working on aqueous separations, spent nuclear fuel reprocessing. So.
That's a something that the U.S. hasn't done very much of.
No, but we're trying to get it to go that way. Yucca Mountain can't hold everything, so we need to recycle the fuel. So,
of course, there's a good reason to recycle the fuel, even if Yucca Mountain could handle it.
True.
To me, I mean, I kind of like the idea of recycling everything, you know, whatever you can. And nuclear fuel is a pretty valuable substance. You think about just throwing it away after one time through. How much energy is left when you...
Oh, they figure about 95% of the fuel can be recycled. There's only a small amount that actually needs that we can't do anything with. A little bit bigger chunk can be burnt up or reprocessed. And then the 95% of it is uranium that can be recycled and put into new fuel. So the current idea would be to put it back into the fast burner reactors.
Okay. Now, the fast reactor, why... Now, you talk about burner reactors. Aren't there something, a different type of fast reactor, like a breeder reactor?
Sure, actually. Fast reactors are fairly unique in that it's fairly easy to modify the designs very slightly so that you can change the conversion ratio. The conversion ratio describes how much of the fissionable or fissile material you generate over the course of reactor operation. So this means that you can operate these reactors in a lot of different states. They can have conversion ratios of 1 so that they can operate for very long times, 20, 30, 40 years, without refueling. They can have conversion ratios that are greater than 1 so that you're actually producing fuel that can be moved to a different reactor. Or they can have conversion ratios that are much less than 1. And in that case, you're actually burning some of the things out of the spent fuel that are very difficult to store in a repository.
Things like plutonium and some of the other actinides?
Actinides, transuranics.
Okay.
Things that have long half-lives that are really the licensing challenge for repository.
Right. Because once you fission it, then what's left over after fission is usually got a pretty short half-life.
Usually something on the order of 300 years for most of the isotopes that are really a concern. And as far as a repository perspective, you're really worried about things that have very energetic decays that provide a lot of heat to the surrounding material.
Well, and that 300 years that people bandy about, that's really 10 half-lives, right?
That's really 10 half-lives.
Okay, so that means that's the time it takes for the stuff to basically be completely gone.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Okay, all right. Now, I have done a little bit of research on the reactor that Toshiba's proposed for Galena,
mm-hmm.
and I happen to recognize that that reactor looks an awful lot like something that Argonne National Laboratory worked on a few years ago. Do you have any idea the background for that?
The reactor that Toshiba provides actually is a project that Argonne has collaborated with Toshiba on in the past. We also collaborate with the NRC in developing the capabilities that they need to effectively license a reactor of that kind. So it actually goes back to a lot of the reactor designs that were proposed when the fast reactor programs were first moving from the experimental kind of prototypic stage and starting to go toward commercial deployment before the U.S. decided not to stop the recycling programs during the Carter administration.
So you're involved in the process, the ongoing process for this licensing of the what is a 4S reactor in Galena?
We are. We're actually involved in supporting the NRC in that licensing process.
Very good. Very interesting. Now, I happen to know David from other events. David is a very energetic member of the North American Young Generations in Nuclear and the Young Members group
from the American
American
Absolutely.
Society. Yeah, and he's actually not got as many ribbons on his badge today as he usually does. So he's only here as a judge, an exhibitor, and a speaker. Okay.
It's a quiet weekend, right?
Yeah. Yeah, David is one of those guys that it took him a while to learn to say the word no when people ask him to volunteer.
I'm still not very good about it. I see something that needs to be done, and I just can't help myself. It's really hard.
Well, and, of course, that's a very interesting position to have in the nuclear industry these days, because I think there's a lot of passivity out there. Okay, I don't like the word the passive voice. Okay, and people talk about, well, if the nuclear renaissance comes, my question is, what are you doing to make it come? Okay, it's absolutely not going to arrive by itself.
Yeah, I think that's one of the big challenges we face right now as an industry, that we've kind of gotten into a little sense of complacency, perhaps, that there hasn't been a lot of growth over the past few years, at least not new plants. We've had a lot of growth in capacity, but you know, there hasn't been a lot of visible growth in workforce. So it's really easy to be complacent about and say things in a very passive way. I think it's a challenge for us all to get out of that habit and start thinking about how we make things happen rather than worrying about if they happen.
Right.
Just like you say. So that's really been my motivation in not saying no. You know, I wanted to make sure there were lots of opportunities for young professionals to get involved in the organizations that can help them. Primarily through knowledge transfer was my major concern. I saw that when I started at Argonne, I was the young guy for a very long time. And the average age was pushing something like 65 in my division when I started. So it was a big challenge there, trying to absorb all this knowledge about fast reactive design and safety in a very short time before all these people started to retire.
So how many people does Argonne National Laboratory expect to need to hire in the next, say, 5 years?
You know, I really don't know that number. It's a difficult thing for us to judge because the Department of Energy programs that sponsor Argonne's work are really undergoing a lot of change as well. So the direction of the Department of Energy and of Argonne is really difficult for us to predict. We're not in the clear position that the utilities are right now where we can say we're going to need 500 people in 15 years because we really don't know what people we need. It's going to take us a couple of years, I think, before we really have a clear picture of where we're going. There's a lot of things that really influence that. The rapid growth in high-performance computing and interest in simulation has really changed the landscape at Argonne. We're really very quickly shifting a lot of our focus from experiments to really high-performance computing activities. The difficulty in doing large experiments in a national laboratory like Argonne is located near a major metropolitan center in Chicago. That also changes the way we function. So we're kind of wrestling with that a little bit. It's going to be a challenge for us to figure out.
Okay. Now, at one time, you used to do your experimenting out in Idaho. Do you guys still have a relationship with the Idaho National
Lab? We do. And I think, that's probably, in the beginning, it was very difficult for us because of the change with Argonne West becoming part of Idaho National Lab. A lot of those connections were broken. A lot of folks that were absorbed into INL were not happy about that change, and they're no longer there. So a lot of our personal connections were no longer with the lab. But I think in the last year and a year and a half, we've really developed a very collaborative relationship with them on a lot of programs, and we're starting to see the same kind of benefit from each side that we've seen before.
Thanks a lot, David. Good to see you again.
Thanks, Rod.
Well, it looks like I'm going to split this episode up into two pieces. Still have some more interviews to share with you, but I've reached a maximum number of tracks I can put into a GarageBand podcast. So come back and check out episode number 85, Tech 2, if you want to hear more. Wait a minute. I just thought of something. If by any chance you decide that you want to get in touch with any of these potential employers, why don't you tell them that you heard about them here on The Atomic Show? I'd appreciate that. Bye.
Hi, everybody. This is Wayne Trammell asking you to join me for the working week. Not the whole week, because neither of us has that much time, but for the Working Week podcast. That's the weekly digest of research, news, and opinion from the pages of managementissues.com. And that's the world's leading site for business, management, and human resources. My guests and I will talk about the news that matters to those of us just trying to survive the working week. That's workingweek.thepodcastnetwork.com.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.